again, everyone. This is Ron Ott with today's look at sports. Before Jaguars cornerback Jalen Ramsey left the team to go on paternity leave late last month, he began the process of forcing his way out of Northern Florida. It began with Jacksonville's Week 2 loss to Houston, during which Ramsey was seen arguing on the sideline with coach Doug Marrone. After the game, Ramsey asked agent to formally request a trade, which the cornerback later explained was because of issues more with the front office and the organization than the coach. Some disrespectful things were said on their end that made me definitely want to walk out and call my agent, he said, of former NFL wide receiver Nate Burleson's podcast, 17 Weeks. When that didn't immediately result in a deal, Ramsey resorted to a little bit of tradecraft by calling in sick with the flu. In another era, this may have been one of the most controversial stories in the NFL season. The best cornerback in football, a bright young star still ascending toward his athletic prime, arm wrestling management, and a deal in the middle of the season. But in 2019, Ramsey has plenty of company. The Dolphins' first-round pick, Minka Fitzpatrick, desperately wanted off the sinking ship, requested a trade, and quickly was dealt to the Steelers on September 16th for a first-rounder. He is reportedly not the only one in Miami working on a similar arrangement. It's not just a Miami thing. Defensive end Jadeveon Clowney, the Texans' number one overall pick in 2014, refused to sign his franchise tender with Houston over the summer and also headed off an attempted trade to the Dolphins before landing in Seattle, one of his preferred destinations. And of course, there is Antonio Brown, who before the start of the 2019 season orchestrated a trade from Pittsburgh to Oakland, then demanded that the Raiders release him so he could promptly sign with New England. He has since been cut by the Patriots and plans to file grievances against the Raiders, the Patriots, and potentially the NFL. While the cases shared common traits, players trying to force their way out of the organizations that drafted them, root causes in each are different. But the fact that the NFL, arguably the most oppressive league in terms of player freedom and movement, is seeing its team start to blink when confronted by its workforce is significant. Broadly speaking, football has seemed to loosen its vice grip on players who have for decades been treated as if they should be paying the NFL for the right to play and not the other way around. A healthy erosion of its military-industrial complex, too, has helped shed the sense of duty and what that was for generations unfairly coupled with the job of carrying a football down the field. Especially given the health concerns that shadow their working and post-career lives, players today seem more comfortable showing their self-interest. Players successfully seizing control of their careers isn't happening because teams haven't seen it work in the NBA, a league that has long figured out how to cash in on the excitement of a player transaction. And it certainly isn't because the players, as some head-in-the-sand commentators like to reason, are millennials. Football players I've talked to seem to be less and less convinced that they live this gilded and privileged life. They feel fortunate, of course, but they are also acutely aware of the cost. Post-career challenges, both financial and health-related, have changed the way they view their chosen career path. A football team and its fan base are no longer akin to a country who must be served. It's a business operation. A coach is no longer the unquestioned leader you follow blindly into every battle. He or she is a boss, and if your boss is a jerk, you'd use every tool at your disposal to find a better job. If you strip away that dated sense of duty, it's easy to see all the positive side effects that come from more players asserting control over their careers. It may disincentive tanking, given that players don't want to waste their time and the league is paving stones on a road to a championship they'll never see. It most certainly punishes organizations running substandard operations. It will make an owner, a coach, and a general manager think of their employees less like worker ants and more like, gasp, people. Players used to be called traitors when they left the city that welcomed him or her into their open arms. They were called selfish if they asked for more money for their services, or as in the case of Fitzpatrick, to be sent to a better team, which could eventually bolster their price on the free agent market. With the average NFL career lasting less than 3 years, who could blame them for wanting the most out of their short time? With Jalen Ramsey and Melvin Gordon, it becomes that much easier for players to throw up his hands and say, this doesn't work for me anymore. Like so many other workers, athletes want fast and foremost to do what is best for themselves and their families. This idea of establishing a healthy workplace culture that allows employee empowerment has been a driving force behind some of the nation's most successful businesses over the last decade, including companies like Google and Salesforce. When people feel supported and heard and are well compensated, they perform better. It's good for the company. It's good for the product. Why should someone wearing a helmet and shoulder pads be thought of any differently? With his John Wayne gait, push broom mustache, basso profundo voice, 6'3", Bruce Bochy cut an imposing figure as a big league manager. It was a humorous lie. The truth and magic of Bochy were in the deftness of his touch, be it acquiring the deepest trust from his players or wringing the slightest advantage out of a baseball game. Every one of his players was better for knowing that Bochy was on his side. Only Connie Mack and Bochy held down a big league managing job for 25 uninterrupted years, and Mack owned the team for which he worked for 50 years, the Philadelphia A's. Bochy's run with San Diego from 1995 to 2006 and from San Francisco from 2007 to 2019 ended on his own terms. At age 64, Bochy retires with a career record of 2003 to 2029 and one loss, but was 44-33 in the postseason when he did his best work. He does so as a future Hall of Famer, and along with such predecessors as John McGraw, Casey Stengel, and Earl Weaver, a rare management brand. Bochy, who was hired by the Padres general manager Randy Smith because he wanted someone who could handle a staff, ran games with the foresight of a chess grandmaster. The man who once wrote a book about taking walks made his reputation mostly in the wisdom of his 11,783 ambling, teetering trips to the mound to change pitchers. It paid off in the World Series wins with the Giants in 2010, 12, and 14. Those championship teams were 13-3 in one-run postseason games. His bullpen was 13-2. Most famously, in Game 7 of the 2014 World Series, he pulled his starter, Tim Hudson, after only 28 pitches, and used as his ace, Madison Bumgarner, for the last 15 outs. It just wasn't pitching. Every year, fading veteran players would show up in San Francisco, and Bochy, like some wizard of a life coach, would squeeze the last best baseball out of him. Aubrey Huff, Andres Torres, Pat Burrell, Cody Ross, Angel Pagan, Marco Scotturo, Hunter Pence, Mike Morris. Bochy, ever humble, would claim the cool weather in San Francisco kept his older legs fresh. At 64, Bochy's 1 year younger than his father, Gus, was when he was fatally stricken with a heart attack. Bochy underwent 3 heart procedures from 2015 to 17, but in the past 2 seasons said his health has been robust. His next job is to dote on his grandkids, stay connected to baseball in some way, which already has fueled speculation that another club may convince him to manage again. In spring training, when Bochy announced that he was retiring, he explained in the manner of running a game, "I've managed with my gut," he said, "so it's a gut feeling. It's time." Dick Vitale sounds on the phone exactly like he sounds when he calls a Duke North Carolina game. He can't help himself. He's eating breakfast at First Watch Cafe in Lakewood Ranch, Florida, on the morning of the Sweet 16 games, trying to explain how Purdue can stop Tennessee's Admiral Schofield. When he hangs up, he talks hoops with anyone who strolls past and notices that telltale bald head and foghorn voice. But with the basketball conversation will come a filter and a more serious message. The only thing that 79-year-old Dickie V cares about more than college basketball is raising money for the pediatric cancer research. He considers that his full-time job. Since he held his first gala in Sarasota, Florida in 2006, he's raised $25.2 million. At this year's gala, Vitale raised another $4 million. If he hits that number, it will be because he and team spent another year asking everyone they help meet for help. This frustrates Vitale. He believes it shouldn't be this hard to raise money for a cause this worthy. If Clemson, if Alabama, if Notre Dame, if Ohio State, if Michigan called a meeting and said they wanted to raise millions because they wanted to elevate their football facilities, they get it in no time, Vitale. I got to beg and plead, and it's needed. It's so needed. He passes out flyers, rattling off names of children shown, children who have lost their fight against cancer. Vitale can also list the names of success stories, those who fought and survived. He hopes that someday he can make the second list longer than the first. Vitale began working to raise money for cancer research after his friend and North Carolina State coach Jimmy Valvano was diagnosed with terminal bone cancer in 1992. When Vitale threw himself headlong into the fundraising for pediatric cancer research, and after watching his 5-year-old neighbor Peyton Wright fight that disease, a rare form of brain cancer, Peyton died in 2007. "I saw what her mom and dad went through," Vitale says. "And the funeral ended, I went to them and said, we're not going to let her die in vain." Peyton's father, Patrick, chuckles when he meets people who think Vitale's chief passion is basketball. "It pisses me off when I meet people and they go, oh, he loves is the ACC. I can't stand that guy," he says. "You don't even know what he does, man." I attended my first Dick Vitale gala in 2011. So writes Andy Staples for the Sports Illustrated. "And I didn't want to be there. Cancer took my mom in 06 at age 57. I'd seen up close how viciously and indiscriminately it kills, how it can suck the soul right out of a person. I didn't understand why anyone would try so hard to beat a foe that obviously couldn't be beaten. But as I listened to the stories of cancer survivors and fighters and of parents who lost children, Then that crazy bald man screaming on the stage for more donations that will lead to more studies, that will lead to more treatments, I began to feel something different. Hope. If people like Dickie V and families like the Wrights are willing to fight this hard, maybe cancer isn't unbeatable. Maybe those people just need a few more of us to join. These are desperate, fractured times. Tiger Woods' thrilling win at the Masters, but he complicated the racial confusion, the sex addiction, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Clemson's coach, Dabo Sweeney, a rival worth of Nick Saban, made millions from unpaid labor and says he would quit his job if players were ever paid. Americans channel surf and they for customized version of the truth. Shelves and bookstores across America are stacked with polemics lamenting a decade of decline of shared values. Michiko Kuatani, the Pulitzer Prize winner, former New York Times critic, titled her last book, The Death of Truth. The center, if ever there was one, no longer holds. An old discredited name has recently pushed us closer to the brink. Lance Armstrong is the most despicable creature, an athlete who preyed on the public that needed inspiration. He was every bit the performance-enhancing drug user his critics accused him of being, and while he was cheating, he was selling himself in the form of a cancer survivor who beat odds and stood as an example of hope of those facing death. He used people, struggling people, at their lowest, at his most impenetrable shield, for anyone critical of him was indirectly undermining that and their hope. They, the people, would come to his defense, and Armstrong, normally guilty, would let them. He said critics and newspapers and magazines for libel, knowing guilty, would let them. He sued critics and newspapers and magazines his money to destroy reputations. He used the position to further destabilize a free press that already had few friends. And then finally and fatally cornered in all the lies and alibis, Armstrong admitted he was dirty all along. His fall was not a moment to rejoice. But at least one can hold the smallest expectation that his chapter was closed and he would take his money and the tatters of his reputation and mercifully leave the public eye. Nike's Livestrong's brand that was once his and made the company billions severed ties with him. He had done enough. Now he's back. Of course he is. In a time of kleptocracy and commerce, when disgraced is commodified and lauded as smart business, and when enough of us never enough of us. Armstrong's return was inevitable. For the celebrity class, rehabilitation as commodity is always an opinion, even when the disgrace is completely unrepentant. The 30-minute special in May that NBCSN aired on Armstrong was the latest celebrity insult. If there was some national clamor to resurrect Armstrong, I clearly missed it. Yet he was allowed a national platform to rub his lies in the public's face. So writes Howard Bryan. He was vile in his craveness, embodying the time, enabling to be proud for his lack of integrity, his utter unprofessionalism. We did what we had to do to win, Armstrong says. It wasn't legal, but I wouldn't change a thing, whether it's losing a bunch of money or going from hero to zero. As another example of surrender, people in the wake of interviews suggested to me that there is something benign about Armstrong and his deceit, because his deceptions occurred while he was inspiring millions, thus producing a net benefits of sort. A similar line of thought exists when sports teams willfully defraud the public by taking payments from the armed forces to enable the military into sporting events, not for the sake of patriotism, but for money. Instead of being insulted, many defended the odious practice along the lines of, it was deceit, sure, but it was deceit for the right reason. There is a common thread to this thinking, not only in the public's unwillingness to demand accountability from its public figures, but also in the expectation that cheating is an acceptable practice. Now, even good works. For what exactly is the value of good work if it requires deceiving the public? Even worse than this notion is the acceptance that people who are hurt, their reputations ruined, the money spent protecting oneself against people like Armstrong, are merely sacrifices that don't deserve the public's attention or support. They don't matter. The celebrity class has won fame, allowing them unearned forgiveness. And too bad for the poor sucker who is right but doesn't have the money for a team of lawyers. Armstrong doesn't even fake contritions anymore. It wasn't legal, but I wouldn't change a thing. In 2019, it's a liar who ends up getting a TV show. The waitress high steps through the gauntlet of carry-on bags, maneuvering her way to with four young men dressed in sweats bearing their college logo. Two kickers, a holder, and a long snapper are piled into vinyl seats. Here on the crumb-lined booth in the airport, Chili's is where their journey ends. In the first Sunday of May, and four other waitresses for their afternoon flights out of O'Hara, they're among the many specialists who have left Howes Hall empty-handed, save for the Bears nameplate peeking out of an unzipped backpack atop a pile of duffel bags just outside the restaurant's entrance. Between sips of beer, Spencer Evans, one of the kickers, mentions that the competition seems strange from the start. Long snapper Luke Adoni wonders, and sometimes still does, if these 3 days in Lake Forest were all a weird dream. Well, let's talk some food. St. Louis' signature dish is toasted ravioli, but a more prosaic offering is ubiquitous at Busch Stadium, and the Cardinals claim to hawk more of that than any other major baseball league, nachos, specifically nachos and meat. We're baseball heaven, says Busch Stadium executive sous chef Norman Taylor, and that's before the game even starts. This isn't bird food. You don't lay off the high cheese or other ingredients. We go through 50 12-pound cases of chips a game. We smoke our barbecue in-house and finish off 970 pound cases of pork butt last year. So 20 different stations sell nachos. You can't walk 50 feet without passing one. We've got beef, pulled pork, diced chicken tacos, some condiment bars with six toppings and two types of pepper sauce. Our nachos come in a home plate box, and take both hands to carry them out of the place where you bought them. Welcome back. Close your eyes and visualize three rivers flowing gently with no rapids to disrupt the flow. And now take a look at this image, and what do you think? What a Steelers fan sees, oh no, that reminds me of when we evacuated our house after a weird ceiling stain appeared. We thought it was mold, but it was actually a cherry 7-Up that I left in the attic. I blame my annoying cousin Marty, who was staying with us that summer, so thankfully he got sent back to his house. To this day, he signs his Christmas card, "You know you made that mess, love, Ben." And then there's the "What a Raiders fan sees." That's Roman, an exchange student who went to my high school. He always wore enough axe to clear out the lunchroom, and he only knew enough English to say, "We are families, dud, 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 dud," over and over and over again. But damn, he was so good at tennis that we loved him. I can sort of smell the wild spice body spray right now. Can you please get me some fresh air somewhere? Well, that's it in sports for today. I'm Ron Ott.